this year was dedicated by Brian and Simi Kleinberg in honor of their parents, Howard and Nancy Kleinberg, and Mish and Rochelle Rosenblum, who continue to inspire and guide them with their wisdom, experience, and love, as well as to the teachers of the YU Torah Mitzvah Beit Midrash, Rabbi Turchina, and myself, for all that we do in the community.
Okay. So, what I want to do is I want to focus on one theme that appears in the Megillah that really, in certain ways, flips a theme that appears in the rest of Tanakh, which is sort of par for the course in the Megillah, for which the theme is V'nahafochu. But also, in many ways, highlights, in many ways, fixes, if you will, or corrects what exists in other ways in Tanakh, or presents a different possible perspective. I mean, I want to do that by comparing the by comparing the story of the Megillah, or at least one incident of the Megillah, to another incident in a totally different sefer in Tanakh. So, as background, who is the main protagonist of the Megillah? This is not a trick question, right? Who's the main protagonist of the Megillah?
You don't need to know the difference between them.
Right. Well, Mordechai. You're assuming it's Mordechai, but who it's named for, right? The protagonist, really, or at least at a certain point, becomes Esther. But you're right that there's a certain part of the Megillah that for which the protagonist, the hero, is really Mordechai. And when exactly does that change take place? So that change takes place at Perek Dalet, when Mordechai actually confronts Esther and tells her, I want you to save the Jewish people. Now, that moment, besides for it being the climax of the Megillah, I think in many ways is so out of sync with what happens in other places of Tanakh that it highlights the extent to which V'nahafochu is central to Megillah. And I want to show you why I think that is, okay? So, let's start with the Pasuk in Shoftim. The context of the Pasuk in Shoftim in source number one is when Avimelech is attacking a city. Avimelech is the not-so-righteous son of Gideon. So, he wages war against a Jewish city. And Vayavo Avimelech ad HaMigdal, Vayilachem bo, Vayigash ad HaPerach HaMigdal l'sarfo ba'ish. So Avimelech is in the middle of this conquest, and he comes to the tower, and he attacks it. And he comes to set it on fire. Vatashlech isha achat pelech rechev al rosh Avimelech, Vataratz et gulgalto. So a woman takes a upper millstone, right? So the millstone has two pieces. So it takes the top of it, which you use to crush the wheat, crush the wheat into flour, and throws it and cracks his skull. Vayikra mehera el hanar noseche lov vayomer lo shlof karbicha umotiteni pen yomru li isha haragatu vayitkareu naaro vayemot. And what does he say? He says to his weapon bearer, "Kill me." Right, just kill me, because the last thing I want is that people should say I was killed by a woman. And this, in the ancient world, is understandable. Right, the protagonists, the heroes of military battles are men. If you lose to a woman, right, that is the epitome of disgrace. Now, look at number two. Number two is really the story, with that background, that I want to study and contrast it with the Megillah to highlight really the novelty of what's going on in the Megillah, the novelty of the Mordechai-Esther narrative. So, we're here talking about, right, if there's one story before Esther where you have military heroes who are women, it is the story of Dvorah. Right, the story of Dvorah. Now, here's how the story begins.
Well, not quite begins, but almost begins. Vatishlach vatikra levarak v'navinom mikedesh naftali. So, Dvorah is the shofetet, but she calls to Barak to be the military leader. Vatomrei lav halotziva Hashem Elokei Yisrael lech umashach debahar tavor v'lakachta imcha aseret alafim ish b'bnei naftali b'nei zvulun. God has sent you and said, go get yourself an army of 10,000 people. Umashach dielecha el nachal kishon et zisra sartzva yavin ved rechvo ved hamono natiu v'yadecha. Don't worry, I'm going to take Sisra. I'm going to take Yavin. I'm going to take all of his chariots. And chariots, you have to remember, are the ancient equivalent of a tank. And that's essentially what it is. And I'm going to give them over to you. Right? So this is going to be a very impressive miracle. Right here you have Sisra with 900 tanks. And the army of Barak is not even, it's not just tanks against infantry. Right? What are the weapons that the Jews tend to have in this time period? What? Yeah, all types of things. Basically, things that they have from the farm, right? So, right, we know from David that some people have slingshots, but that's, right, it's not a military tool. It's what he uses, as he says. I use this to kill the wolf and the bear who came to attack my sheep, right? And people have, some people can have spears and knives, but mostly, if you read through it, right, they have the thing they use to hit the animals, right? Shamgar ben Anath. Right, the previous, well, not really previous, actually simultaneous, just in different parts of Israel. But the previous in Sefer Shoftim, he kills them with whatever you call it, the yeah, whatever it is they use to hit the animals. Right, they use all types of, you know, they use shovels. Right, you know, like sort of the classic movie picture of a mob of farm people with pitchforks. That's basically what the Jewish army tends to look like. Okay, so you're thinking that you have 900 tanks versus 10,000, which turns into 32,000, which turns into 300. Fine, whatever. There's going to be a miracle, and he's going to be defeated. Vayomer ila Barak. But Barak says to Dvorah, Im telchi imi v'halachti, v'im lo telchi imi lo elech. If you come, I'll go. You don't come, I'm not going. What does Dvorah say? Vatomer haloch elech imach. I'll go. But you're not going to get any glory out of this. Because God will sell Sisra to a woman, so he's going. Right. So here we have a story where, and this is going to start to sound familiar, and this is why I want to set it up, to understand the Megillah. I want to contrast these stories to really understand the Megillah. What's the theme here? Right, you have Dvorah telling Barak, you take the helm. And what does he say?
I'm not doing it unless you come.
Right, I'm not doing it, I'm giving it over to you. And what does she say? She says, fine, I'll come, but it's going to not lead to honor. I don't know if it's quite disgrace, but we'll see, it is going to be a bit disgraceful, because not only is it going to be remembered by me, it's going to be remembered by that the victory was in the hands of a woman, not you, the military leader. And that's not good, right? That's not good for your reputation. So there's two themes here, right? One theme, which we already know from the story of Avimelech, is that the woman being the military leader is something disgraceful for the men involved. And the other theme that you have here, which you didn't have in the Avimelech story, is one person who is the hero offering to give over the reins of battle to somebody else. In this case, it is turned down and turned back, right? You flip, and Barak gives it over to Dvorah, right? Dvorah was the shofetet, but Barak, she offers it to Barak, but that's the way it's supposed to be. Barak is supposed to be military leader. But then you have the second half of it, which is Barak, who's supposed to be the hero. The man gives it over to the woman, but what does the IL say the result will be? Disgrace, right? You will not be honored. Right, or at least lack of honor. But as we'll see in a moment, it's not just going to be lack of honor, it's going to be disgrace. And here, I want to show you something fascinating in number three. So let's see the end of the war. So who are the heroines of the war of Barak? So it's obviously Dvorah, but who's the other heroine?
Yael.
Okay? Now this story, Judy Klitzner, in her excellent book called Subversive Narratives or something like that. No, Subversive Sequels. It's a nice title. right, about stories which subvert assumptions earlier in Tanakh, she points out how much this story plays with Barak. So we look at three. Vatetse Yael Likrat Sisra. Vatomre Lav Sura Adoni Sura Eli Altira. So Yael comes out. Now, right off the bat, it starts playing with language, because Vatetse Yael is military language, right? To go out to war, right? Yael is going out, except where is she? Tetse, from where? From the Ohel. Right, so we're starting to flip. Not only is the woman the military leader, but she's not doing it on the battlefield. She's doing it from the home. Right? She's doing it from the Ohel. Right? So Barak, by giving it over to Dvorah, is starting to flip things. It's not just going to be that a woman is going to win. It's that a woman is going to win the war from the house. Right? From sort of the stereotypical place of the woman. Vayaser Ela, and this is why she calls it subversive. Right? Because it subverts the normal assumptions of Tanakh. So he comes and she covers him in the ohel with a blanket. Now this is classic. This is a type scene. Right? This is something you find all throughout the Tanakh. Right? The man comes in from wherever, from traveling, from battle, and he asks the woman, give me a little bit of water. Right? And what's the next thing in all these stories? Right, they get married or whatever. Right, there's a nice ending. So we start that way. So she gives him, but she gives him milk. So he says to her, "Stand by the ohel." Now there's a very subtle subversion here, very subtle. What does amod petach ohel mean? In English, it doesn't translate, but amod petach ohel means stand at the tent. Good, but translate amod. What's amod? What pronoun goes there? Ata. It's male, right? Amod, right? Right. He doesn't even realize it, but Tanakh, instead of amdi, it's amod, right? In the male. In the masculine, stand there. Va'ayam yishavo sheilech va'amar hayish po'ish va'amart ayin. Right? If they'll ask, is there a man here? Say no, which is also ironic, right? Is there a man here? No, there isn't a man, right? I mean, he is about to be in that same situation where he's going to be humiliated, right? Normally, he should be the military victor, but he's about to be destroyed. Va'tikach ya'el eshet chever yeted ha'ohel. Right? Now, what does she take? She doesn't take a weapon. She takes the nail from the ohel, again, right? The symbol of the ohel, of the, right, inside, not the military field, of the home. And she uses it to kill him. Vatasemet ma'kevet biyada, vatavoy la balat, vatidka et yate birakato. And she takes it and she drives it through his temple. So Judy Klesner points it out, and this is beautiful. I didn't notice this until she pointed it out. What's the word that the Torah uses to describe his death? Vatidka, I hope I bolded it for you. Vatidka et hayateid birakato. Right? His temple. What is birakato? What word is that? Barak. Right? When Dvorah said, you will not get glory from this battle, she meant it. Because instead of Barak killing him, it's Yael killing him birakato. She is taking the place of Barak. Right, very, very explicitly. And then Barak has been chasing. Let me show you. You're looking for. Again, birakato, and she said, "Look, I've killed him. It's not done yet." Right, this subversion is not done yet, right? Because Barak gave up his responsibility to be the military leader, right? There's a mild criticism. He's, right, clearly not a negative figure in the story, but he's a somewhat weak figure. Dvorah gives it to him. So if you look, right, in the middle of her song, in number 4, Bimei Shamgar Ben Anat, in the days of Shamgar, Bimei Yael, Chadlu Archot, the caravans ceased. Now, what does that mean? So the caravan seat means that Sisera was, right, his army was terrorizing the Jews on the way. It's Chadlu Arachot. Except where does Chadlu Arachot come from? There's only one other place in all of Tanakh that the words Chadul Arachot, Chadal and Arachot come up. Only one other place in all of Tanakh. And it has nothing to do with this. It's Sarah when she describes that she can no longer have children. Right? She said, Chadal liyot lisara orach kanashim. Right? Right? Chadal orachot is a play, clearly, on Sarah. Right? V'holchein nidivot yelchu arachot al kakalot. Chadlu ferazon b'Yisrael chadelu. Right? Everything stopped. Ad shekamti dvara. Ad shekamti dvara. Shekamti yem b'Yisrael. Until I got here. Right? He doesn't get any of the honor. Right? Dvara said, you won't get the honor. She's right. He won't get the honor. She's going to sing the song, and it's going to be her glory. But she's not done. Devorah is not at all done. Look at number 5. Bara Chalon. So later on, she describes that there are other women, right? Sisra's mother, who is in the classic state. Right, she's waiting at home for her husband for her son to come back. Why isn't he coming? She's crying at the window and she says, where is Sisra? Why is he so late? Chachmot Sara Tanena. So her advisors told her, Afita Shiv Amar Allah, and she too is saying this to herself, Halo Yimsu Yichalku Shalal Racham Racham Tayim Lirosh Gever Shlal Tzvayim Litzisra Shlal Tzvayim Rikma Tzeva Rikma Tayim Litzavare Shalal. Don't worry, they must be dividing the spoil they found. Racham Racham Tayim, right? A woman or two for each. Spoils of dyed clothes for Sisera, spoils of embroidered clothes, a couple of embroidered cloths around every neck as spoil. Don't worry, he's doing what every victor does. He's busy taking spoils and taking women.
Is this the same Sisera that we have in the Midrash from Rosh Hashanah for the shofar?
Yes, exactly. This is the pasuk, right? This is where we get it from. So, Judy Klitzner points out. Okay, wait a second. Right? It's not just Barak that gets humiliated here, but it's Sisera. Because think about the words of what she just said. Where is Sisera? His mother says, oh, he's definitely victorious. What's he doing? Racham racham tayim, right? Which is a very derisive way of saying woman, right? It means womb, right? That's what it literally means. A womb or two for Sisera. But what actually happened to him? A woman or two led to his death. Right, so she's playing with this convention, right? Because she told him, she told Barak, that if you don't take your responsibility, you want me to come, fine, I'll come, but you will lose all the glory in the process. That's the basic theme of the Dvar story, and she gives it to him, right? She is very harsh, both in terms of what she says and what she alludes to. But if you take that story for background, so first of all, we learn two important things, right? One is that we learn that in the world of Tanakh, and at least in military context, this is still basically true, war is a man's world. And for a woman to win, for the reason to be victorious, is quite disgraceful to the man who loses. And that's one thing we learn. The other thing we learn is that being the case, if a man is given the task of being a military leader, and he not only shirks his own responsibility, but he gives it to a woman who that shouldn't be a responsibility, that's even worse. Right? That's terrible. But now, you think about it, wait a second. You shouldn't win, right? It shouldn't be, military victory shouldn't be carried out by women, and if a man has the responsibility, and he's supposed to be the hero, he definitely shouldn't give it over to a woman. And then suddenly you realize that we get to Megillas Esther. And Megillas Esther, in the story of Yael, she does it. And Yael and Dvorah are the heroines, but it's explicitly stated that it's a negative. But the same thing happens in the Megillah, But this time, it's not a negative. It's not a negative at all. Right? And if you go to the critical moment of the Megillah, what happens? So, we'll read it in just a minute. But what does Mordechai do? He has been the hero until Perek Dalet. And everything that Esther has said, that has done, is only because Mordechai said it. And what does he do in the middle of Perek Dalet?
He hands it over. Switches.
He takes it over. And is that looked down as negative? No. And the question is, okay, what's going on in the Megillah? So Yoni Grossman has a fascinating point. And he notes, the theme of the entire book is undoubtedly Vina HaFochu. The book of Megillah is about Vina HaFochu. And he has a beautiful analysis of this. He points out that there is a perfect chiasm, right? A chiasm following the Greek letter ki or chi, right? Which is an X, right? Where the theme that starts the Megillah ends the Megillah, and so on and so forth, right? Until you get to a turning point in the middle. So if you think about how the story starts, you start off with two parties, right? The public party and then the private party, or really the men's party and the women's party, and you end with two or three parties, right? The two parties of Esther, and then you have the celebration of the Jews, right? So you have these parties at the beginning, the parties at the end. You have the death of Vashti at the beginning. You have the death of Haman at the end, right? If you keep following, and what is the exact middle of the Megillah? If you had to guess, what would the middle of the Megillah be? So it's slightly before that. A little bit before that, what?
Calls for his book.
Exactly. Nad Hamelech is the dead center of the chiasm, which makes sense. It's the turning point in the book. Right? Nad Hamelech. That's the turning point, if you think, right? And even if you think at that point in the chiasm, the step before that is Haman going to prepare the gallows for Mordechai. The step afterwards is Haman bringing Mordechai on the royal sus, right? You think about it, right? That is exactly the changing point in the Megillah. It's where everything turns. But he notes, and he said, as he makes a disclaimer, he said, this is not feminist analysis. This is simply what the Megillah tells you you have to function. He says, the key to understanding, or at least one of the keys to understanding the Vina Fochu in the Megillah is its use of gender roles. Why? So, number six. Let's read this story. Right? Let's read the story. This is the beginning of the Megillah. The first time we learn about gender roles. Number six. V'temayin ha-malka vashti lavo b'dvar ha-melech asher b'yad ha-sarisim v'ektof ha-melech ma'od v'chamata b'arabo. So Vashti said she won't come. Right now, remember, it's asher b'yad ha-sarisim. What does that mean, asher b'yad ha-sarisim? It means that the seven most prominent officers of the king walk into the woman's party and call Vashti. Right? This isn't a private message. He doesn't send a letter. He doesn't send a text. Right? He sends a parade of high-ranking officers, and Vashti says, "Right, I'm not coming." So Ahasuerus is furious. So the king says to his wise men, "What's Yodei Aitim?" What is Yodei Aitim in Pshat?
For the future.
So people think it's astrologers, but the symbol is Pshat is Yodei Haitim, people who know history, historians, right? Why? What's he asking? Is there even precedent for this? What do you do when the queen publicly refuses what the king says? So the seven most high-ranking officers who are Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech. Now, what does Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech mean? So I heard this week, I didn't know this, but there's a good chance what it means is exactly what it says, that they saw the king. Why is that a novelty? Because apparently there was a law in ancient Persian kingdoms that no one saw the king except for his closest advisors. He stayed behind a veil. No one was allowed to see his face. Only the most prominent people or his wife were allowed to even see him. We were able to ro'e pnei hamelech, and that's why when Haman falls out of favor to Achashverosh at the end, what do? Pnei Haman chafu, which at least according to many mefarshim means they covered his face, because once you're out of favor, you don't get to see the king, right? Even before they kill him. So the seven most high-ranking officers, the only ones who are his intimates, are called in, right? Now, this whole thing is absurd, right? Because it's a marital affair, and he's calling in the highest-ranking officer to figure out what to do. Kidat ma la'asot b'malkav ashti. What's the law? Al asher lo astad ma'amara melech ha'chashverosh b'yad ha'sarisim. That she didn't do what the king said. Vayomer mumuchan lifnei ha'melech v'asarim. So mumuchan is stuck. Mumuchan has a quandary. What's his quandary? If you were Mimulchan, if you were the king's officer, and he asked you what to do when Vashti didn't listen, what are you going to say? You're stuck in a very tight situation. Because what happens if you tell the king, cool it? Right? Calm down. It's not such a big deal. So what's he going to do? He's going to kill you. Right? Because he's angry now. So you can't say anything. But what's he going to do if you say, okay, so punish her? Then he's going to kill you when he comes down, right? Meaning you're stuck. He's either going to kill you now or he's going to kill you later, right? He's this is not somebody who you can reason with. So what are you going to do? So what do you need to do? You need to walk a very fine line. On the one hand, you need to give him a way to vent, but you need a way to what? Not trace it back to you. Right? How are you going to do that? Frame it. And tell the king, oh, she didn't do it to you. She did it to everybody. And Ahasuerus is somebody who's very worried about public opinion. So say, look, don't. If you tell her to kill, if you say kill her in your wrath, then when he calms down, the king will say, well, why did you do that? Why'd you let me do that? Why didn't you tell me to calm down? So what do you say? You pretend it was rational. Because then later on, he can't turn back on it. Because he's not going to say it was a rash moment. He's going to look back and say, oh, that was a great policy decision. Or you have to come up with a way of veiling it. So Mimuchan comes up with a chap. He says, what are you going to say? Lo ala melech livado avta vashti amalka kiel kol asarim val kol amim asher b'chol medinot amelech Ahasuerus. This was against all the officers and all the nations and all of the kingdoms of Ahasuerus. Ki etzei dvar malka kol anashim lavzot balehen b'enehen. Because now everybody's going to go home. And their wives are not going to respect their husbands. Be'omram ha-melech l'Ahasuerus amar l'avi et vashti amalka lefanav v'lo va. Because everyone's going to hear Ahasuerus said to Vashti, come, and she didn't come. All the women are going to hear, it's going to be a disgrace. So issue a law that cannot be transgressed, that because Vashti didn't listen, her status as queen will be given to someone better than her. And the word of the king was heard throughout the realm that all wives should treat their husband with respect, high and low alike. Right? So here, it's not just that I have to infer from Sefer Shoftim, right, that women are the second class here. There is just a law that frames the whole book. Right? The whole drama starts with a law. That women, that's what sets everything in motion, right? Is a law that women have to listen to their husbands. But now you think about it and you realize, wait a second, the framing of the entire book is that women have to listen to their husbands. Now, what is the theme of the rest of the book? Let's be careful. Do women listen to their husbands?
Best to listen to Mordechai if you say that.
So the beginning, for sure, right? Esther listens to Mordechai. Is not, you know, according to one Medrash and Chazal, her husband. According to Pshat, not. But yeah, she's listening. It starts off that Esther's not. But what about everybody else?
Zeresh,
right? Is
she's thinking of very original things for him?
Exactly. She's thinking on behalf of Haman. But what is she doing? Right? She doesn't tell him what to do. What does she do? She does tell him, but she, right? She gives him an idea so that he's like, oh, that's a great idea,
yeah.
And. And what about Ahasuerus? Ahasuerus, the entire time, does Esther ever tell him what to do? No. What does she do?
She said, let's have a party.
Right? She invites him to a party. She requests so that he'll come up with what he needs to do. Right? So there's a moment in my Big Fat Greek Wedding that basically summarizes the Megillah. Right? This is basically how I understand the Megillah. Okay? Right? So there's a moment. You've seen the movie?
Yeah.
Okay, so in the movie, right? So Tula at some point wants to move from working in the restaurant and she wants to work in the travel agency. So she tells her mother and her aunt of her new idea, and they say, okay, so we'll get Gus to say yes. But Tula says, but how can you do that? The father is the head of the household. You can't tell him what to do. So what does her mother say? The father is the head of the household, but the mother is the neck, and she turns the head in whatever direction she wants it to go. Right? If you think about the Megillah is framed by that joke. Right? The Megillah starts with every wife has to listen to what her husband says, and then continues with either wives telling their husbands what to do in the case of Haman, or manipulating their husbands so their husbands do what they want to do without even realizing that it was planned by the woman. Right? Esther just plays with Ahasuerus's head until she gets everything she wants. Right? Ahasuerus, she wants Ahasuerus to feel like he's the knight in shining armor. So she sets up the situation so that he gets to feel like he's the knight in shining armor, even though, right?
Well, he does offer her up to half of the
mahu. Right, he has it, right? Correct, but she, right, what does she do? She makes a party. She, right, instead of asking, she makes a party, and then she makes a second party just so that he's just like, he doesn't know what to do. He's like on the edge of his seat, and she's making him, and this is a longer story from the Megillah, she's making him feel jealous because he's already starting to think that maybe there's something going on between her and Haman, just setting up the situation so that when Haman, when Haman's begging for his life, he'll jump to the conclusion, which is totally irrational, that he's trying to rape her in the palace, which makes no sense whatsoever in context, right? Now is not the time to do this, but he's not thinking straight, right? She's manipulating him, right? She's creating conspiracies in his head just so that she can get him to the point that she needs. And the whole Megillah plays on that joke, right? That the men think that they're in charge, and the women either explicitly boss the men around or play with their minds until they think that they're doing what they want to be doing, and they're not. They're doing what the women planned that they would do, right? The entire thing, and he points out that that twist on gender role is just part of v'nahafochu. The part of v'nahafochu is that. That's the cynical part of it, right? That's the Ahasuerus, right? That's the Haman, right? That these people, especially if according to Chazal, you think Memuchan is Haman, right, it gets even worse, right? Memuchan is the one who promulgated the law that husbands, that wives have to listen to their husbands, and he's the one who ends up listening to Zeresh, which leads him to run in the middle of the night into Ahasuerus's courtyard and set the tone for right? Zeresh's advice, which he listens to, is what leads to his own downfall.
So
right?
Just to clarify, I think I did it once. The Mefarshim think Memuchan is Haman?
Right, so according to Chazal, Memuchan is Haman. According to Pshat, it's someone different. But according to Chazal, it's the same. And if it's the same, it only makes it worse, right? Because here, the person who's behind the law follows his wife's advice to his own demise, right?
Okay.
So the whole book plays on this joke. But there's one point in the book which doesn't play out in it as a joke. And that is Esther Perek Dalet. Esther Perek Dalet is where Mordechai appoints Esther, essentially. Vayageid lo Mordechai et shkol asher karau v'ed parshat ha-kesef asher amar haman lishkol et ginzei ha-melech bayudim labidam. So Mordechai tells Esther everything that happened about how Haman set this decree, how he paid off the king, etc. V'patshegin k'tav hadat asher nitan b'shushan l'hashmidam natan lo l'harod et ester l'agid la v'l'tzafot aleh l'avol ha-melech l'tchanein lo l'vakesh milfanav alama. And the fact that it was sealed with the king's seal, that there was a law that the Jews will be destroyed. And he showed it to Esther to tell her and to command her to go to the king to beg for her life, right? To beg for the lives of the Jewish people. So who's clearly in control here? Mordechai. Mordechai knows about the decree. He's telling Esther what to do. She doesn't even know about the decree, right? Forget, she's not doing anything. She doesn't even know about the decree. And Mordechai is the hero. Vayavo Hatach, v'agid l'Esther divrei Mordechai, and Hatach tells Esther, What's going on? V'tomer Esther la'atach v'tzaveu el Mordechai. And Esther turns back to Atach and says, Kol avdei ha'melech v'am medinot ha'melech yodim. Asher kol ish v'isha asher yavou el ha'melech ha'chatzer ha'pinimit asher li karei achat dato la'amit. She says, what do you want from me? Everybody knows that any man or woman who comes to the king into the inner chamber who wasn't called, he gets killed. Levadash me'asher yashilo ha'melech et sharvita zahav v'chaya. Unless the king puts out his royal scepter and limbs va'ani lo nikreti lavol ha'melech zeshlo shimyom, and I haven't been there 30 days. Now, what is she saying by that? Now, first of all, what month is this? Nisan. Nisan, you have 11 months. Right, so she could be saying a whole bunch of things. Right, so she could be saying, I haven't been called in 30 days, and therefore he's going to call me soon anyways, so what are you rushing me? Right, why am I putting my life in danger? Alternatively, she's saying the opposite, which is, Ahasuerus has a harem of God knows how many women, right, of all bitulot in the entire kingdom, and I haven't been called for 30 days. Right, which means that knowing Ahasuerus's, desires, there's probably another woman who is his consort for the last few days, right? So what am I going to do? I'm going to barge in, in the middle of dinner, and there his consort's going to be there, right? Or even if she's not there, right, he's thinking about other women. I haven't been there 30 days, right? Now is not the time for me to go in. So you think about the moment, right? Mordechai is the hero, and he's begging Esther to be the heroine. Now, this sounds very familiar, right? This is Barak and Yael. Yeah. Now, in the case of Yael, she eventually accepts, but she says it's going to be disgraceful. But here, something else happens. So first, you get a back and forth. First, Esther says, no, I don't want it. Right? She offers it back. I don't want it, right? I'm too scared. I don't want it. Vayagidu l'Mordechai divrei Esther. So Mordechai is told what Esther said. Vayomer Mordechai la'ashiv al Esther. So he tries again. Al tidami v'nafsheich lima late beit ha'melech b'kol ha'yudim. Don't think you're going to be saved in the king's house. Ki imacharesh tacharishi ba'ed hazot. Because if you're quiet now, revech v'atzala yamod li'yudim mimakom acher. We'll be saved. There will be salvation from somewhere else. But you'll be lost. You and your father's house will be lost. And who knows if you came to be queen for this reason? Now, there's something fascinating what he's doing psychologically here. Because we always remember this wrong. Right? Everyone, if you didn't know the Megillah, right, you were just summarizing it for someone, what would you say Mordechai said to Esther? What's the best thing you could tell Esther at that moment? Why should she act? Right, what's the right without looking in the Megillah? If you wanted Esther to act, what would you tell her?
You're destined to do so.
And what's gonna happen if you don't? We're all gonna die. What does he say? The opposite. He says, I'm not saying this because we need you. We don't need you. God will figure it out. We don't need you. You need to be the heroine for you. Right? It's not for us. Right, which is fascinating. You got to think about his psychology there. He's not saying that they need her. He's saying she's positioned because she has the opportunity to be victorious. So if you think about how much this is a flip of the Barak Yael story, it's not just that he's turning to Esther, because you could say he's turning to Esther out of necessity. But the psukim go out of your way to tell you he's not turning to Esther out of necessity. He's convinced he doesn't need her. He's turning to Esther because he wants her to be the heroine for her own sake. And he wants her to be the person who saves Klal Yisrael. Vatomer Esther l'hashiv el Mordechai. And what does Esther do? Okay. And now everything flips. Because until now, Esther has been doing exactly what the Megillah says she should be doing. She's been listening to the men in her life. And then Mordechai begs her to take leadership, and it flips. It flips just like that. Lech kenoset kol ha'yudim ha'nimtzeim b'shushan. Go and get all the Jews v'tzumu alive al tochlu v'al tishlu shosh yamim laila v'yom gam ani v'narotai atzum kein. Go and fast, and I'll fast, and my maidservants will fast. V'chein avol ha'melech asher lo chadad v'chasher avati avati. I'll go, and if I'm lost, I'm lost. V'yavor Mordechai And he goes and he does exactly what Esther says. But here, is it negative? Not at all. How do we know? Because at the end of the Megillah, who's the hero again? Mordechai and Esther. Right? Mordechai and Esther. So I think that when you take the two stories together, right, you take them as foils of each other, you realize what the Megillah is doing. Right? The Megillah is predicated on the notion of v'nahafochu, of flipping.
And it's not a disgrace for a woman to say.
Exactly. Now, while some of the v'nahafochu is clearly meant to be satirical, right, here it's also v'nahafochu, it seems like, in a positive. And this is, right, I like, Judy Klitzner doesn't point this one out, but I like her model, that sometimes stories in Tanakh, as she calls them, are subversive sequels. That they take paradigms in Tanakh and they show you another possibility. And I think that what Esther is doing, the book of Esther, part of that v'nahafochu theme is it's setting up basically the Yael Barak moment all over again. Right? Because it starts with, right? Yes, it starts with Mordechai telling Esther what to do, but then there's that moment of Esther saying to Mordechai, no, I don't need it. Right? I don't need it. I'm scared. You continue leading, essentially. And Mordechai says, no, you have to do it. And you don't have to do it because it's necessity. It's one thing to say it's necessity. Right? No, it's not necessity. It's not necessity. I want you to do it for you. Right? Which is not what you have in Yael. Right? Yael, she takes it out of necessity because Barak won't do it. And she says it about necessity. Right? She says that there was, we were waylaid by Sisera, Ad Shekamti, Dvar Ad Shekamti, and Israel, until I came. You needed me. Mordechai says, listen, we don't need you. You need you. You need to be the heroine. And I think when you take the two stories together, you realize the extent of the v'nahafochu of the book. Right? Because yes, on the local level, it's flipping, right? It's making fun of Haman, and it's making fun of Achashverosh, and it's flipping everything that they thought that would happen on their heads. Right? Haman or Mimuchan is saying that women have to listen to the men, and then Haman himself ends up listening to Zeresh, that leads to his downfall. And it starts with parties. It starts with parties celebrated by Achashverosh, where he gets angry at Vashti, and Vashti is kicked out and loses her power, and ends with a party orchestrated by Esther, in which she becomes more powerful. Mordechai becomes more powerful. Right? Everything is flipped. Everything is v'nahafochu. Right? That's the theme of the book. We know that. But one of the things it does is the most powerful of the v'nahafochu is that it plays with gender roles. Right? Because it said, right, if it's all about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then nothing that exists anywhere else in culture is relevant. It doesn't matter that Tanakh itself thinks that it's disgraceful, right, in military battles for the women to win from Avimelech. It doesn't matter if in the Barak and Avinoam and Barak ben Avinoam and Yael story and Dvorah story, Dvorah says it's not a good thing for you to give up your role as leader. In the Megillah, it offers you another version because it's telling you no. In the theme of v'nahafochu, part of it is that yes, God will almost comically turn the tables, but some of it isn't comical. Sometimes v'nahafochu is dead serious. That in order for God to bring salvation, sometimes models have to be flipped. Sometimes paradigms have to be shattered. And if in that story, Barak is looked down upon because he gave it over to Yael, here Mordechai turns the tables. He's Dvorah, except he's the man. And he turns to Esther and he says, if you take it, so then the glory will be a woman's. Right, if you think about what he's saying, it's a flip. Right, he is Yael, except because of the gender, he's telling her, take it. And again, it's not because it's necessary. It's only because the exact opposite of what happened in the Yael and Dvorah story. Dvorah said, the man shouldn't give it up, and if he does, it's disgraceful. And if he does, everyone will say that they were saved by a woman. And Mordechai says, yes, that's exactly the point. I want you to save us, not because we need you. I want you to save us so that everyone will say that we were saved by Esther. It's a total paradigm shift. It's a total paradigm shattering. And I think that when you compare it to the story of Yael, Dvorah, and Barak, you realize that it's not an accident. Right? The theme of the Megillah is exactly that. That the greatness of Hashem's salvation is you never know how it's going to come. Sometimes simply by reversing what you thought would happen, but sometimes more, sometimes by shattering paradigms, by shattering precedent. Because sometimes you need new models. Sometimes God wants to do something different. And therefore, if God wants it, it's not negative. Right? There's actually another perspective that's possible here. But I would just close with this, that I think what's fascinating in Megillah is that it does this. It doesn't just seem to be, well, many other things in Megillah are clearly local v'nafochus. It seems like this, toch kedei na'afochu, right, v'nafochu is actually offering a different model. And is actually saying, yeah, what's true in Shoftim is true in Shoftim. But that's not the only possibility. That's not the only cultural possibility. That is a possibility. That's the world of Shoftim. That was a model at a time. Right? But it's not always the model, because there might be times where a different model is called for. And while in Shoftim, we look down on it, in Esther, we celebrate it. And it doesn't end the way it ends in Shirat Dvorah. In Shirat Dvorah, she said, if you give it over to a woman, you will be disgraced. That's not what happens in Esther. In Esther, by Mordechai willing and encouraging Esther to be the leader, to be the heroine, he becomes the hero. Right? He started as a mere Yoshev Bishar HaMelech and ends up as Mishneh LaMelech HaChashveirosh, as the viceroy, essentially. Right? And Esther and Mordechai both emerge as heroes. Right? So it tells you not just can you shatter paradigms, right? But sometimes if you're willing to realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't necessarily want the world to run the same at all times, right? By being able to recognize that sometimes times change things, you will also be honored. Right? So while the end of the Yael story was because the man gave it over to the woman, he was disgraced. The end of the Esther story was because he recognized the necessity of having Esther do it. They both get honored. They both get power. And I think Yoni Grossman's point is well taken here, that this is not, you know, a feminist shiur. I mean, you could take it as it's such, but it's not. The Megillah is focused on Afechu in 100 ways, but perhaps the most extreme way in which the Megillah shows the power of Afechu, the power of God to flip assumptions, to flip paradigms, to shatter paradigms, to say that salvation will come however it's going to come, right? In the words of Mordechai, Revach v'atzala yavo liyudim m'mekom acher. Things can happen any way. It could come in a traditional way. It can come in an untraditional way. It doesn't matter. Different paradigms will work at different points in history. But the ability to recognize that because God can do whatever he wants, models can shift and change, and they should, and that you should embrace the moment and realize when it is time to change something because God is calling you to do the opposite of what he normally calls you to do for, that is the theme of the Megillah. And if I had to summarize the theme of the Megillah, it would be that. It's that Im hacharish tacharish verazot. If you're quiet now, revach v'atzala yavo liyudim m'makom acher. God can save you in any way, with any paradigm. Whether it's a classic paradigm, the opposite of a classic paradigm, with what's normally disgraceful, with what's normally encouraged, it doesn't matter. All you have to recognize that when your calling comes, whether it's what you thought your calling was, whether it's what society thinks your calling is, or it's not, your responsibility is to realize when God is calling you, when God wants you to participate in the drama that he's setting up. And if you do, then you will, right, you'll get glory. And everybody else, like Mordechai, who recognizes that it's time for a paradigm shift, will in the end of the day also be honored for it. And that, I think, is the fundamental message of the Megillah, is that ability of God to bring salvation in the most unexpected of ways, even in ways that are literally the opposite of everything we've assumed before then, but that's exactly the theme. Revach latzal yavo v'yudim imam acher, v'at u'beit avich yovedu. That God can shatter paradigms, but if we're not willing to take the risks and to actually put our foot forward when God is asking us, do something that's different because this is how I want you to be saved, then we'll still be saved. But the people who aren't willing to risk it and realize that God can do things in new ways, they won't be remembered because they'll have missed their opportunity. And I think that's really the message in many ways of the Megillah, or one of the many messages of the Megillah. They can only be fully seen when you compare it to that story, which it seems to quote-unquote, subvert, which it seems to flip on its head to show you the extent to which God is capable of bringing salvation with no matter how many paradigms he needs to shift to do that. So, with that...